This podcast is brought to you by the GOSH Learning Academy.
Hello, and welcome to Master the MRC PCH. In this series, we tap into the expertise here at Great Ormond Street Hospital to give you an overview of a topic on the RCPCH exam curriculum. So whether you're revising for an exam or just brushing up on a need-to-know topic, hopefully this podcast can give you the information that you need. I'm Dr. Sarah Ahmed, a paediatric registrar and the current Digital Learning Education Fellow here at GOSH. In today's episode, we're going to be talking to Dr. Mary Mathias, a consultant haematologist and the Haemophilia Centre Director at Great Ormond Street Hospital. We're going to be talking about haemophilia, covering etiology, diagnosis, management, prognosis and complications. This corresponds to learning outcomes in the haematology and oncology section of the MRCPCH exam curriculum. This episode is going to be split into two parts. In part one, we're going to cover pathophysiology, presentation and diagnosis. And in part two, which will come next week, we're going to cover management, complications and prognosis. Mary, thank you very much for coming on the show and talking to us today.
Not at all. Great pleasure.
So we always start these podcasts with some learning outcomes. So what would you like people to get out of listening to this episode?
So I think just a fairly sort of basic understanding of haemophilia, which is the commonest severe bleeding disorder that we manage, and really most fundamentally when to pick up the phone and reach out to a team like ours, because we absolutely don't expect people to have all the answers, but what is the best thing is if they recognize the potential and pick up the phone for advice.
Amazing. Hopefully we will cover all of that. So let's start at the very beginning. Haemophilia. What is haemophilia?
So haemophilia is an inherited bleeding disorder. So the genetics are that it is an X-linked recessive disorder, and it's something quite familiar to a lot of GCSE pupils because it can come up in the GCSE biology syllabus as an example of an X-linked disorder. It is the result of a genetic mutation in either the factor 8 or 9 gene is an absence or a relative reduction in the amount of one of two clotting proteins. So we all have a number of different proteins that help our blood to clot. They are named 1 through 13, and confusingly, until you get used to it, in Roman numerals. So factor A, 9, V111, and 1X. And haemophilia comes in sort of mild, moderate, and severe form. So severe haemophilia is a factor 8 or 9 level of less than 1 international unit per deciliter. Moderate is between 1 and 5. And mild is anything above 5. So the mild haemophilia has a big range. You can have a level of 6 or a level of 30.
And am I right in thinking that a deficiency in factor 8 is haemophilia A and in factor 9 is haemophilia B?
That is correct. And haemophilia A is the more common of the two. Both are rare. So the incidence is around 1 in 10,000 for haemophilia A and 1 in 20,000 for haemophilia B. I mean, I think that's a statistic that's going to evolve because historically, the majority of adults with severe haemophilia didn't survive long enough to reproduce. And that, thank goodness, is no longer the case in the developed world. So the prevalence will change over time. But it's still a very rare disorder and severe haemophilia. And so, for example, an average general practitioner may see one case in a lifetime. But I think for children's doctors, the sort of key moment is that they are likely to be responsible for it, the moment of diagnosis. And because obviously for many families, there is a knowledge of haemophilia in that family. And so a baby is born, a male child is born, known to be at risk, and they will be screened at birth. But that only accounts for somewhere between 50 and 60% of our patients. So the genetic mutation is what we call the new mutation in around 30-40% of families. And so this is where a general children's doctor comes absolutely to the fore from our point of view, because they are the people that will potentially have the first contact with those families. So it's what to look out for and what to think, or could this be?
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about presenting features, but before we do that, can we just talk a little bit more about the pathophysiology? So the deficiencies in factor 8 and 9.
Yeah.
How does that lead to bleeding?
Yeah. Very good question, because for those of you all who are remembering those ghastly diagrams of the coagulation cascade, which is the kind of thing that sticks in your brain as a nightmare, you will recall that the classical idea of coagulation is based on an intrinsic and extrinsic pathway. So factor 8 and 9 are in sort of one arm of that sort of Y-shaped diagram, if you like. And then the other arm of the Y-shaped diagram is sort of factor 7 acting with tissue factor. Both of those bits of the pathway generate thrombin. If you think of in clotting, thrombin is sort of a bit like it's the crucial bit. Once you've created the thrombin, you then go on to activate fibrinogen, which is the end result of a clot. So a clot is a combination of fibrin strands mixed with red cells, platelets, some white cells, and that's what a clot is, and it you know what a scab is, if you like. So the clotting element of that, the clotting protein element of that, is creating fibrin. So in an unaffected patient, somebody who has normal clotting, the way the process works, and this is obviously giantly simplified, yes, largely because that helps me, but the first trigger in your body, if you like, is tissue factor binding with activated factor 7, which creates a small amount of thrombin. And that thrombin then does one of those amazing positive feedback loops that we have in physiology. And it triggers off the activation of factor 8, factor 9 through factor 11. And that then creates more thrombin. So the initial trigger is now thought to be the 7A tissue factor thing, creates a small amount of thrombin, and then you get this giant positive feedback loop. Imagine one of those sort of huge sort of arrows that makes it much bigger. And so the interesting thing, and if you think about hemophilia in practice, you absolutely see this. So if you have hemophilia and you cut your finger, it's a trivial cut. Yeah. You don't bleed all over the floor for hours. Usually that kind of injury will lead to, you know, they might need to hold it for a little bit longer, a little bit more pressure. But I wouldn't anticipate a big problem with that. But if it was a bigger cut, or again, classically in children, it's a frenulum tear, or they've bitten their tongue or their cheek, they will make an initial clot, fibrin-related clot, but it can't activate that positive feedback loop through the factor 8 or 9 if they've got a severe or moderate deficiency. So the clot is not strong, and it's not resistant to the sort of breakdown, the sort of normal recycling of a blood clot, which is effectively you break it down eventually. So that's called fibrinolysis. Yeah. And the thing is that children with hemophilia and other bleeding disorders, they can't make a stable, long-lasting clot, and it sort of washes off. Yes, that could happen on your finger, but it's much more likely to happen in your mouth or any of your mucosal surfaces, because saliva and all the rest of it. And then what will happen is they re-bleed. So the classic bleeding pattern in a new child presenting with severe hemophilia is not, you know, they've cut their finger and they're bleeding on the floor. It's they bit their tongue 3 days ago and their mum is bringing them into A&E because it stops and starts and stops and starts. That's what you look out for. Okay. They can make some blood clot, but it's just not lysis resistant. And so that, you know, it's not, I think there's a common misunderstanding, certainly within the public, of, you know, they think of a bleeding disorder. When we talk to teachers, they're sort of expecting the child to spontaneously, you know, have a bleed that's all over the floor. It can be anywhere. It can be following an injury or a, you know, biting their toe or something, but it can also be internal. And in severe hemophilia, it can be spontaneous or what we call minimal trauma. And what I mean by that is the trauma of a toddler standing up and putting pressure on their knee joint for the first time. That is what I mean by minimal trauma. So the classical pattern of bleeding in severe hemophilia is into the joints and into the muscles with very little injury. So typically, newborn babies, non-mobile babies, don't bleed very much. They might bruise with normal handling. But it's often when they start to move that you see the problem. So it's baby starts crawling, lots of big, fat, juicy, black, very prolonged hematomas under the skin. But actually, that's when you might start to see a painful knee, or, you know, they're not using one of their limbs when they previously have been, and they're obviously distressed and in pain.
Okay.
And these are the kind of kids that the pediatrician will see and will have to think about this as a diagnosis.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, doing a quick think back of patients in the last 5 to 10 years. So one of them is the mucocutaneous bleeding. It's the top, the fold, tears their frenulum. And, you know, obviously a child without bleeding disorder, they might have a little bit of blood in their saliva for a few minutes. But this in a severe haemophilia or moderate patient, or even mild at the lower end, you will see this pattern of the parents thought it had stopped, but then it started again. And it stopped and started again. And just to put that in context, I've seen a child with a factor VIII level of around, in the end, it was around 6 or 7, drop their hemoglobin down to 60.
Oh, wow.
Over the course of a couple of weeks of that pattern of a bleed stops. So it was never a point where the family were gracious, this is really alarming. And it took them a little while to get to the threshold, but they thought they needed to take him to A&E. So that's one way. There is the sort of absolutely classical hot, red, swollen, painful joint. Knee, ankle is quite a common one. Elbow could be associated with trivial injuries, pulling injury, but it may not be associated with any trauma. Muscle bleeds, particularly in little ones, it's sort of toddlers, because they can be quite chubby, can't they?
Yes.
It's much more difficult to identify those. But so the pattern there is the family is saying he's in pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they recognize they've got a child who's normally quite sunny, and then, you know, they're maybe not moving one arm more. And obviously there's a huge differential for that,
yeah.
But it's just to be thinking, is it a boy? Mm-hmm. Are they somewhere between 6 months to 18 months? Are you seeing any bruising? Because again, if it's severe haemophilia, by that point, I would expect there to be bruising. And we might come back to bruising in a minute, because obviously that's a really tricky one in general pediatrics. And the other sort of, obviously the red flag alarm, you know, every bell ringing, is the neonate.
Yeah.
So a baby just been born, or really any time after that, to be honest, who presents with anything to suggest an intracerebral bleed.
Yes.
And again, there is a crossover with non-accidental injury, and I think this is a huge issue. But the thing about severe haemophilia, which is, I mean, never say never, moderate haemophilia or mild haemophilia causing a non-traumatic intracerebral bleed is extraordinarily rare.
Yeah.
Not saying it's a never, but I would expect there to be some element of trauma, certainly in mild haemophilia. But for severe haemophilia, then there doesn't need to be any associated trauma at all. And it can obviously happen at birth, and that is the most tragic presentation in a family where there is no history of haemophilia. So that the mum does not know she's a carrier. The baby's born. They may be fine initially and then, you know, deteriorate rapidly. A scan is done. And it obviously, I mean, and this is, you know, teaching my grandmother to suck heads. Any paediatrician would check the clotting screen at that point.
Yeah.
But it can be a very quick pickup. But the other thing to bear in mind is, you know, we've had, I can think of 3 or 4 babies who've presented like that. By the time they've had a clotting screen, that, you know, it's muddled up because the child's already had to be given blood and,
yes.
Or they have a clotting screen. Maybe the clotting screen wasn't great. It was not clearly an isolated prolonged APTT because the child may have DIC by the point of the blood being taken. So they get thrown appropriately. They get blood clotting products, FFP, sometimes cryo. And it can take 2 or 3 days to actually unpick it and pick up that they've got severe haemophilia. And I mean, I can think of, you know, 3, 4, 5 cases in my career where that's been the case. So it, again, if there's any doubt, if it's a sort of out of the blue, you know, it may be perhaps not a very difficult birth. Get on the phone, reach out to somebody like us or your nearest pediatric bleeding disorder center, because we can help to walk through that and help to unpick it. And sometimes it's a question of doing the factor assays, and you might see that the factor IX is normal or a little bit low. That's probably the most critical time to reach out. And we'd much rather have the conversation about baby with an intracerebral bleed where we can go in the end, look, this is just one of those tragic things, the clotting's normal, than there to be a delay.
Yeah, which I think brings us on quite nicely to thinking about that question of differentials and investigations. So if you have a baby who has got a bleed, like you said, or is coming in with repeated bleeding, and you mentioned the coagulation screen already. What other investigations would you do, and what other differentials are you trying to rule out?
Okay, so, I mean, I'm very much going to focus on the hematology. Mm-hmm. What I want to do is diagnose the hemophilia, or say it's not away you go and do all the other things you need to do around, say, a monoarthropathy. So if you have a boy with hemophilia, you will be able to pick that up with a clotting screen. You won't be able to say whether it's hemophilia A or B. Mm-hmm. So the classical pattern will be isolated, prolonged APTT. Mm-hmm. If a child has severe hemophilia, their APTT will be over 100.
Okay.
Okay. It might be 90. Right? If it's moderate, it will probably be somewhere between 60 and 100. Mm-hmm. And if it's mild, it could be only very slightly prolonged, depending on how mild it is, right? Essentially, the older the child, the milder the hemophilia will be. So that's one of those things that is sort of quite obvious to me, but may not be obvious. Let me explain. If you've got a really severe form of hemophilia, as long as you're born in this country, you will reach somebody like me almost without exception before the age of two.
Okay.
It may be within a few days of birth. It may be within the first few months of life. As with all medical conditions, there is a range, isn't there, of severity. So even with severe hemophilia, there are patients of mine who have presented at around the age of three or four. I can think of two in 20 years. So that is very unusual. Even with an unmeasurable factor, 8 or 9 level, some children bleed a bit more than others and some will present sooner. But basically, anybody over the age of four who was born in the UK, so I'm not talking about somebody who's moved into the country from abroad where they may not be able to diagnose these conditions.
Yeah.
They will have already been diagnosed if they have a severe form of hemophilia. Mm-hmm. So if you're seeing a 10-year-old in A&E with a swollen knee, yes, I think you should do a clotting screen unless there's a very obvious alternative cause, because it could be a mild form of hemophilia. So there's partly a sort of, you know, what age is the child in front of you?
Yeah.
But if it's a boy and they're under the age of four and you're seeing bruising, a pattern of bleeding, recurrent swollen joints, recurrent painful swollen muscles, absolutely do a clotting screen. And I think at that point, probably it's pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because what we would then want to do is the clotting proteins that cause a prolongation of the APTT, which is factor 8, factor 9, but also factor 11 and 12. And von Willebrand factor can do that as well. So it's not, at that point, I would not expect a general pediatrician or somebody in A&E to be working that out on their own. It would be reaching out to a haemophilia specialist team, and then they will be able to say, this is how we're going to organise these tests.
Okay.
So if you're at a district general hospital, mostly they will not be able to do factor 8 or 9 levels. They will send them to another hospital. And what you want to do is to be communicating with, you know, somebody like our team to say, you know, you're at hospital X, your samples will go to hospital Y, but on this occasion, could you send them to us?
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. So I think we're very keen to be involved early on, particularly if there's a possibility of a severe patient.
And just thinking a little bit more about differentials, you talk about the other bleeding disorders you need to rule out, and I suppose also NAI as well in bleeding issues.
Absolutely. So hemophilia A and B are the commonest severe bleeding disorders we deal with. But there are, obviously, you can have a severe deficiency of any clotting protein, and they have very similar presenting features, and in particular, intracerebral hemorrhage.
Yeah.
So, and they will cause a different pattern of abnormality of the clotting screen. So we'd be focusing on hemophilia, but if you see a child with cerebral bleed and they have a giantly prolonged prothrombin time, or the PT and the APTT, I mean, again, absolutely pick up the phone.
Yeah.
With the rarer bleeding disorders, they are generally autosomal recessive. So the other things you're going to be asking in the history are the family related, and you might not get that clear, you know, yes, my grandfather had hemophilia type pattern.
Yeah,
because the recessive disorders can be buried for generations before they come up. So those are within the differential. But yes, for the general pediatrician, in terms of, if you like, sort of hit rate, you're going to be presented, I don't know by what proportion, but way more cases of non-accidental injury, both in terms of intracerebral bleeding and in terms of bruising.
Okay.
So it is a big problem. But I think there's some guidance now which is helping all of us, which is a position statement specialist advice paper, which has been published about hematological investigation of non-accidental injury. And essentially, it is do a clotting screen, do a full blood count to ensure that the platelet count is normal. And at that point, that's really where you need to stop.
Yeah.
Without calling somebody for more specialist advice.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing those things, you will rule out a significant thrombocytopenia, obviously, but you will also rule out a severe bleeding disorder. If the clotting screen is normal, you will rule out a severe bleeding disorder, apart from, because there's always an exception, isn't there? Apart from one specific recessive disorder, which occurs in approximately 1 in 1 million people.
Okay.
So to put that in context, so there's something called factor 13 deficiency, which is not reflected in the clotting screen, and you have to specifically assay the factor 13. So if you have a child in front of you with an intracerebral bleed or recurrent unexplained bleeding, parents are consanguineous, that is, again, a reason for a phone call.
Okay.
But that is, you know, putting it in context, that's a very rare situation.
Okay.
So I think with the NAI, current advice would be if you've got a normal clotting screen, you've got a normal platelet count, the parents are not consanguineous, then you've done, that's due diligence.
Okay.
And so bruising at that point is less likely to be caused by a clotting problem. And again, it's not black and white, is it? So normal children bruise. Children with even very well managed and controlled severe hemophilia bruise, because that's normal.
Yeah.
So it's about the position, you know, all of the things around the non-accidental injury in terms of position and explanation and so forth. So there are some very clear black and white, but generally speaking, if the clotting screen is normal and the platelet count is normal, you could pause on there being an underlying bleed disorder. There can be milder things.
Yeah.
But again, that's not your first line of investigation.
Okay. I will put the link to that paper in the description box if anyone wants to go and have a read of that.
That's the end of part one. Join us next week for part two.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Master the MRC PCH. We would love to get your feedback on the podcast and any ideas you may have for future episodes. You can find a link to the feedback page in the episode description or email us at digital.learning@gosh.nhs.uk. If you want to find out more about the work of the GOSH Learning Academy, you can find us on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also visit our website at www.gosh.nhs.uk and search Learning Academy. We have lots of exciting new podcasts coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you enjoy this episode, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.